All right, everybody. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of In Liberty and Health. Today's guest, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Really enjoyed the videos that he does on his channel and his podcast, The Backlash, with a bunch of other great people who are always welcome on the show. Rebecca and I follow each other on Twitter, but would love to reach out to her and get her on the show sometime. And it's also she kind of I used to follow her for a very, very long time, like 10 years ago, listen to all of her content. But my guest today co-hosts a show with her, and it's absolutely fantastic. And even his solo content is very, very interesting. He kind of does a little bit more, I don't want to say short form, but a little bit shorter than rather like long form podcasts, and is very precise, and he's very, very well spoken, very, very well informed on topics that I find very dear and that I talk about quite a bit on this channel. But before we get to today's conversation, make sure you go to All Links below where you can find my guest, his Substack, everything he's got going on, as well as Tiger Fitness and all that stuff through the links below to get some supplements that I use. I have a package coming with creatine pills, branched chain amino acids, and beta-alanine, because I'm about out of beta-alanine. And I find that taking pills is a little bit more... not necessarily accessible, but I could be a little bit more regular rather than trying to use creatine powder. So as always, use code Kyle, check out Tiger Fitness. And without further ado, let's get into today's conversation about the next American Revolution and neo-masculinity.
Running a business is hard work. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI. From site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want the way you want. And manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
Open the door to savings with beautiful Mastercraft doors at Menards. Mastercraft steel entry doors add security and improve the appearance of your home. Choose from our huge in-stock selection or design your door your way with our free step-by-step design program online or in-store. Save big on Mastercraft doors at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
And welcoming to the show, Cameron McGregor. How you doing, man?
A little bit cold early in the DC. I was hoping the 60s. It's like next week we're a little bit colder, and I'm sorry that it's cold. I prefer 70 and above.
Yeah, I totally.
I'm doing great. How are you, Kyle?
Good, good. But I totally get you. Last week, I live in Pennsylvania, so I'm not that far away from you. Absolutely freezing up here this week, whereas last week it was pretty warm. So yeah, I'm definitely down for the bringing the warmer weather. My wife and I had almost moved to Florida, but unfortunately, it just didn't really work out. So
well, I've been spoiled by good weather because I lived in Miami. I lived in Miami, Florida, Mexico, places like that.
Yeah, well, I'm very, very envious because, I could go for warm weather all year round. I know some people say, oh, well, what about the bugs, the humidity? Look, I don't care. If I never have to pick up a snow shovel again, it'll be way too, way too late. I if I'm ever moving out of, southwestern Pennsylvania, I'm definitely going somewhere. I never even have to think about a winter coat or a snow shovel. So why
yeah,
don't you
tell it's funny. I used to say, and people would often. San Diego has the best weather in the world of any place I've ever been. It's basically 50 to 80 all year. People would ask me, "Well, don't you miss the seasons?" And I would say, "No, I really don't."
No, I totally understand. Yeah, I don't think I would either. I'm a mechanic by trade, and if I never had to stand underneath a car with slush all on it and get dripped on all day, I would be the happiest man on the face of the planet. But people didn't come to talk about the weather as much as I enjoy that kind of stuff. Why don't you tell my audience who you are and what you do?
I am an entrepreneur, a writer, and a podcaster. I have done a lot of different things in my life to this point. I was a former naval officer. I used to teach in the public school system and briefly worked on Capitol Hill and all over the world. So when people ask me, it's somewhat difficult for me to answer that question. But for the time being, I would say I'm an investor and a social media person of some kind.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, in this world, you know, there's so many people that are quote unquote influencers, but no, I do find your work to be very, very interesting. And you kind of talk about stuff that's a little bit more critical at our time right now. So one term that I've heard you use, and it seems like you've kind of originated it, and if not, then I'm giving you credit anyways, is neo-masculinity. Why don't you lay that out for the audience? And what kind of attracted you to that term, and why do you choose to use it?
You know, I have tried to coin a number of terms, I suppose, because I'm trying to get people to reframe how they think about the current world that we live in, especially in the United States and the Western world. People, as I think you well know, Kyle, tend to be very black-pilled. Mm-hmm. They are stuck in these echo chambers that have conditioned them to think rather negatively about everything. And frankly speaking, I just am not. My point of view is very, very different. In Western civilization history and be very positive for the world. Obviously, it's going to be adjustment before we get to the other side of the mess that we're currently in. But in that process, which I sort of term an end of school process, I think it's important to reframe how we think about where we stand in the world today. And one of the terms that I've used to describe that neo-masculinity. Masculinity is basically an archetype. It's a prime directive that informs us and orients us in the world. That being said, archetypes change over time. What it meant to be masculine during the medieval period was different than what it meant Greco-Roman times, and likewise today. So neo-masculinity basically means that we're experiencing a kind of transformation of masculinity to adapt to this world that we're in. Some of that means that it's a resurrection. Masculinity, in some cases, it revolt. And that's really the central thesis of most of my work, which is masculinity that's changing the entire Western world and is probably going to lead us into another epoch, if you will, greatness, I believe.
Okay, yeah, I we're having a little bit of connection issues, but I think I got most of that. You had also mentioned leaders of different countries. Like, I think you mentioned Putin in a video, and Xi Jinping, and as well as the prime minister from Turkey, if I could remember his name, I would say it. But I also kind of thought about Nayib Bukele when you were mentioning some of these world leaders, because if you look at Bukele, it's very interesting because... I'm sure, as you know, and you guys have probably discussed on your show that, you know, it used to be like the murder capital of the world, but then he came in and in his interview with Tucker Carlson, who I'm kind of like 50-50 on, I like him sometimes, sometimes I don't. But I remember him saying that, like, when he first became president, he decided we're going to pray, right? So that right there is kind of like a different note, whereas people think, oh, no, you got to like go right into action as soon as you get elected, right? He said, we pray. And Tucker had also mentioned that. They celebrate fathers for a whole month down there. And that to me was always kind of profound because, in our Western culture here, you know, what do we kind of look at dads as? We look at them as either Homer Simpson or men that just abuse everybody around them. And really, when you think about like the difference in just that alone, like, hey, down in El Salvador, they celebrate fatherhood. Up here, we look at it as like a doofy joke and most men can't even help themselves. So I know that's kind of a lot, but if there's anything that kind of came to your mind, feel free to share.
Yeah, hopefully the connection's a little bit better. I just changed positions. My apologies, Kyle. It's definitely on my end. It is not on yours. I think the gist of your question was about Bukele and what he represents as far as the restoration of masculinity. Was that the gist of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bukele is an interesting character, to be sure. I've not been to El Salvador. Most recently, I was actually in Argentina and Mexico. and they have new leadership in both countries. Most famous, of course, the Milei, you know, talk about in just a second. But Milei, in many cases, doing things that are very different than Bukele. Milei is dollarizing Argentina. Milei is a libertarian champion. So he's trying to dismantle in Argentina. And I think in many ways, Bukele has done exactly the opposite. What he has done is empowered the state to combat organized crime. You know, these are criminal syndicates like MS-13, which are increasingly ferocious in nature. I mean, I don't think people realize exactly what's happening south of the border. When I was in Mexico, for example, I learned that the Mexican cartels were launching drone strikes against the Mexican army. I mean, they had military-grade equipment. They were extremely well-organized and financed. They were they had set up checkpoints where they were looking at cell phone activity of people that were through these various gateways in states and to check their loyalty. Become across Central America and South America. And obviously, that's also been the case. Kelly in El Salvador to build massive prison infrastructure and draconian reforms to come down very hard on organized crime. And secondly, he's a Bitcoin, which I think it makes a lot of sense in stark contrast to Milei, who's trying to immerse or reinsert Argentina into the Western financial system, which I think is a massive mistake. Bukele has taken a very different turn. As far as how that relates to masculinity, I think it applies in this regard. We're dealing with very powerful opposition forces. Organized crime, expression of that, the globalist elite is another, but it's going to demand a more muscular or remasculinized culture. And I think Bukele represents that to some degree. Just I would say a Central America or South American caudillo version of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of glad you also touched on Milei as well, because I consider myself still somewhat of a libertarian. But, you know, as I get older and older, and my wife is expecting in August, well, my wife and I are expecting, our daughter's going to be here. She's 22 weeks right now. But I kind of think about the kind of world I want her to grow up in. And you look at the two approaches between allowing or attempting to allow maximum freedom and the promises of libertarianism. And like I said, as I get older, I kind of look at that and think, you know, maybe most people and a lot of people really aren't capable of exercising freedom in the way that, you know, a libertarian might envision it. And maybe people don't necessarily deserve that. And when you look at Bukele versus Milei, I feel like there's a big dichotomy here. And you look at one country where they've made it drastically better for the average person, which would be, you know, El Salvador. And then in Milei's case, it almost seems like he's just allowing maximum freedom. But in this respect, it's kind of so, you know, the IMF and certain other interests that I'm sure you and I are both keenly aware of, being a certain group of people can come in and then do with the country as they please. Where, like I said, it just seems like Bukele said, no, we're not doing that.
The problem with libertarianism is that, well, there are many problems with libertarianism. I suppose the first is that it's based on something called rational choice theory. This is an idea that goes back to Adam Smith, and it basically asserts probably not true. That's the genesis, if you will, of something called behavioral economics, which was invented by Daniel Kahneman. They showed that it's very difficult to model human behavior. Incentive structures are dynamic, if nothing else. They're changing all the time. These are variable economies. So it's very difficult to build a model of the world, whether it's economic or otherwise, on an assertion that, well, people are rational and they respond to incentive structures, and therefore you can extrapolate what they're going to do, what they won't do. It's very difficult to do that. The Keynesians, incidentally, make similar claims about government activity and how the private sector will respond to government activity. That's something we can talk about more in just a moment as well. Inputs do not necessarily generate calibrated outputs. So that's one problem with liberty. Being the power in that rule of law. A country that does not have rule of law like the United States. This is not an Anglo-Saxon democracy, as most of the world is not. So if you those building blocks establish and sort of entrench an equilibrium of law, then you cannot have a libertarian-like society. In other words, if it's going to express itself, is downstream from the infrastructure of rule of law, the power of the state, the respect for the individual contract, et cetera, et cetera. Not a lot of Americans have embraced. They think, for example, this is what we did in Iraq when in civil war. In other words, the state wasn't sufficiently empowered so that you could structure it in such a way that it would actually uphold contract law and the rights of the individual. So it requires that foundational infrastructure first, and it's a very homogenous culture that seems peculiar to Western people. And that's and something that I don't understand, because they don't understand dynamics that are very different in Argentina from the United States.
Yeah, like I said, there was a okay. Your connection seems to be getting a little bit better, but I think one of the main flaws, and you probably know this as well, and I think you might have laid this out a little bit, is that I think the essential mistake of libertarianism is assuming that the freedom in and of itself is a good, but, really you have to have the high trust. You have to maybe even homogeneity in a lot of these situations to have any kind of libertarian society. And much to, the conversation of Bukele, you do need some kind of strict order and, strict border controls to make sure that, you're protecting the society you want to see, ferociously. I had a lot of libertarians kind of going at me because, I do think it is fair and just for abortionists to be, thrown into prison for the rest of their life for murdering children. And people said, oh, well, the government does that. I'm like, okay, but, you told me what's more realistic, the assumption that everybody can just get along and be free, or that you could have an order imposed of good men and great men that, upholds that society. And honestly, if you ask me, I would have said maybe 5-10 years ago, like, yeah, if you just give everybody freedom, everybody will be fine. But I don't necessarily believe that anymore. I do believe that great men have to impose order upon people in order to have any kind of desirable society.
Libertarian pride itself on, right? And the United States is the tyranny of the government as much as it is you have these legacy government institutions work anymore. If you look at the pension system, for example, designed in the 1990s, the economy was different, demographics were different, and we have never upgraded that system at all. And that commands massive amounts of revenue state has to absorb in order to continue to subsidize it that otherwise would be invested in the private. Again, less philosophically and more mechanically, at a moment in time, mechanisms of governance breaking down because they're old, they don't work anymore, and knowing that
sorry, guys. I think he is having a little bit of a rough connection. It seemed like we had a little bit of a delay. Yeah. He travels a lot. Yeah, Rise of Liberty, good to see you. JC, horseshoes and hand grenades. I don't know which one Ian's that is. Hopefully you guys are doing well. Caravaggio, yes. When he's on the backlash, he's absolutely fantastic, and I highly recommend you guys go check that out. Like I said in the introduction, I've been watching a lot of their content. Blonde had came back across my radar when she interviewed Pete Quinones, and that was like, oh my god, somebody that I really like and consider a dear friend, being interviewed by somebody that I've listened to for almost a decade now. Up, oh, and he is back. Hey,
all right, how's this? Is this a little bit better?
No, it's solid. Well, okay, hopefully you can stay warm out there. No problem at all, man. So we were kind of on about I forget where we're at. But I think it was something about, oh, that's right, abortion and libertarianism, where basically like some people basically would posit that like, oh, no, well, it's technically the government that actually enables abortion and stuff like that. And to a degree, that's true. But like I said, I don't necessarily agree that like, oh, if you just abolish the state, then all this stuff will go away. And some people have said, oh, well, you need to have like this spying apparatus to stop people from having abortions. I'm like, well, you know, once again, I do think it is just and necessary, and I think it's really the only way that you can have any kind of functioning society is to have some, you know, monopoly on force and violence to stop people from doing bad things, controlled by great men. And we can debate all day the ethics of those great men, but at the same time, I don't think you can go without that.
Well, there is an interaction of the two. The issue is, and this is the problem I think that libertarians suffer from in the United States, is that they don't understand that if you're going to have a functional society, you have to have congruence or coherence between the institutions of power and the population itself. Mm-hmm. We don't have that in the United States. Now, their view is that that's because of governmental size. That's not the case. The reason for that is because the government as structured today has been dominated basically by a subversive force that represents foreign interests. That's the issue that we're dealing with, not the fact that government full stop doesn't work. Now, certainly a case can be made that across there are a whole range of things that the government does poorly that it should not otherwise do. But if you don't control the institutions of power and have some kind of relationship of that power with the culture of the body politic, then you have a non-starter whatsoever. So libertarianism, I think, is just a misapplied solution to a problem set that's completely unrelated to its basic principles, namely that we have institutions of power that are old, that don't function properly on the one hand, and on the other hand, that they are actively subverting the United States. That means that we've got to concentrate power to oppose that concentrated power, not sort of fragment into these individualist cells across the country and live in some kind of libertarian parallel universe, which is what a lot of the secessionists and the rest of these folks are advocating. That is a non-starter. That's a recipe for, I would say, surrendering to the powers that be and completely abdicating our responsibility to take back power in the country, which is what I've advocated.
Yeah, I completely agree, actually. And like I said, if you would ask me a few years ago, I would have said, no, we need to just, you know, basically advocate for secession all the way down to the individual. But one point that you brought up in a video that I listened to recently is that you talked about succession instead of secession. Do you want to kind of touch on that and potentially how that relates to libertarianism?
I'm not sure it relates to libertarianism, but sure. It certainly contextualizes where we are much better, I think, sure, than a lot of the other thinking that goes on in right-wing circles. The problem with the right, I would say, is that it's stuck inside of a system that doesn't work anymore, right? In other words, to be right means you have to be right relative to a left. The issue is that the system itself, the political system, the financial system, the economic system, is broken. It doesn't work at all. Some of that relates to what we said a moment ago, that the relationship between the body politic and the institutions of power is completely severed. One has been weaponized against the other. When that happens, typically speaking, you get the collapse of the state. You get the rise of a new order. I call that succession. Now, secession historically in the U.S. basically meant that the states were sovereign entities
that had as much, if not more, power than the central government. And on that basis, they had the legal authority, perhaps the moral authority, to secede, to quite literally separate and govern themselves as a distinct entity. That period of time is over. We fought a war over that, and power prevailed. The strength, the industrial capability, the military power of the Union won and defeated the South, and therefore redefined and, I would say, assimilated that state structure inside the Union. This is a very different period of time. This is an environment in which the state apparatus itself, again, the institutions of power, are basically failing. They're failing financially. They're failing because of wars overseas. They're failing because of internal obsolescence and mismanagement. One example of this is the intelligence suite. A lot of people think, for example, that there's something called a deep state that weaponizes our, I call it the triad. It's basically our intelligence apparatus, which consists of the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI at the Justice Department. Their view is, well, you have some bad actors that have gotten control of this intelligence apparatus and weaponized it against the population. Well, to some degree, that's true. But the larger issue is that nobody's really in control of the intelligence apparatus. You have rogue agencies controlled by factions that have a whole range of interests that we probably don't even know about. In other words, there's no oversight. There's no proper governance at all. When you get to that point, you get a kind of state implosion and then a restructuring. That's what I call succession. And I think we're there. What usually brings that about, Kyle, historically, is either a financial economic crisis or a war. And I think we can all agree that both of those things look likely at this stage. If not, they're already here.
Right. Yeah, I unfortunately agree. When you look at Donald Trump, I've heard people say, oh, we're entering a golden age. And Trump has said that too. And I can't help but think, I looked at like the when he first got reelected, and I was pretty bearish initially. But then, you know, a lot of these executive orders looked pretty good. And I'm like, oh, he might actually be serious this time. And I think you and I are of the same mind. Like, oh, it was he utterly failed his first term. But then now it looked like initially like, oh, things are going to be different this time around. But though as time goes on, I'm like, oh, no, this seems to kind of be business as usual. So where do you see Trump kind of in like the larger right wing movement that I guess you and I inhabit?
He's not. And it's again, it's good that you use the term right. OK, mm-hmm. I am not in principle on the right. If you think about it in terms of the landscape of American politics today, or even in Western Europe, right? I don't represent the right. Why do I say that? The right is a form of conservatism, and conservatism believes in incremental reform and conservation. Mm-hmm. As I said a moment ago, the legacy political structure, our culture, our institution, they're broken. We don't want to conserve them. Now, maybe we want to conserve a political philosophy or the spirit of the founders, for example, that inspired some of these institutions. Yeah, fine. But that was a couple hundred years ago, okay? We're in a different world now. What we need now is to realign the institutions of power with the national identity of the population. That's nationalism, and that's what I am. Donald Trump is the last conservative politician we're going to have. He represents the illusion that you could elect your way into systemic reform. We've seen how that goes. And as you point out, yeah, we got a bevy of executive orders. And how's that working out? It's not working out very well. Why is it not working out very well? To some degree, this is not Trump's fault. This is because the political structure itself is just broken. It's not capable of implementing the structural reforms implicit or expressed in those executive orders. I'll give you a crystal clear example of that. The border reforms, or rather, you know, policing our border with Mexico, building a wall, militarizing the border, that's being challenged in the courts as we speak, okay? That, in other words, that's sort of being bottled up by our political system itself. What does that tell you about the political structure? It tells you that the president of the United States does not have the power as enshrined in law and in actual executive authority to control and protect the population of the country. That tells you that your political system is broken. Now, some people have talked about the unitary executive theory as the principle motivating Donald Trump. And to some degree, I think that that's the case. The unitary executive theory basically says that the chief executive, the president, has uniform control over the executive branch. He can hire people. He can fire people. He can declare the Insurrection Act and take drastic, you might say, presidential imperial powers to act out reforms, okay, or to initiate policy. I think that's where we're headed. I think that's going to pilot us into a kind of Hobbesian moment or a Cromwellian figure that is going to reform the system. I think that's where we're headed. But Donald Trump is not that person. Donald Trump is a man who, in addition to the structural problems in the government that render a lot of his executive orders anemic on the one hand, he also lacks the executive control of his own government. He hasn't restaffed the government. Most of his cabinet is consists of the same globalist actors that staffed the Biden administration. There is a continuity between the Biden administration and the Trump administration. Why is that? Because, Kyle, there is no real right in the country. There is no new third party. There is no alternative staffing mechanism that's going to restaff the government with nationalists to actually implement the reforms that Trump is trying to implement. So we're back to exactly the same problem he had in 2016. He's trying to reform a system from inside that's systemically broken, and he can't do it. What we need instead is to reform it from outside and let the sort of legacy structure implode. And as I said, I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I was on with a couple of my friends who aren't necessarily political Friday night. And he had mentioned, you know, nothing's probably likely to change until people feel like they can't feed their kids. So as I said a little bit earlier, you know, my wife and I are expecting a daughter in August. He said, you know, you're going to be fine so long as you can feed your daughter. But when there comes a day when you doubt that you're going to be able to feed that daughter, that's the day that people start picking up arms. And, you know, I think we all hope that it doesn't come to that. But at a certain point, you got to wonder, like, we're so sedated as a nation. I always say that, like, as long as you can have a Dairy Queen Blizzard, watch porn, and drink a High Noon, then there will be no great rebellion. And I do kind of believe in this elite theory that elites basically kind of move the governing systems. But I don't think anybody's nearly feeling the pain enough. I think that Donald Trump honestly is kind of like a sedation for a lot more radical people, because they look at him and ostensibly people say, oh, he's an outsider. He's, you know, doing all this great work to patch up the government. But I, like you said, and have laid out brilliantly, that he doesn't have control. And that honestly, I think even if he did, I don't think he wants drastic reform. I think that he wants to kind of maintain the system as it is. And that is due to some of the interests at home and obviously some of the interests abroad as well.
Yeah, I've likened Donald Trump to Ozempic. He's the idea that you can take a pill, flush your system, and, you know, shed that extra 30 or 40 or more pounds and get right back to the bad habits that you had before. Again, that's not all his fault. That's just, I think, in the nature of the beast in terms of American culture at the moment. In that sense, he does sort of sedate the masses. However, the issue is that economically speaking, I think the United States is contracting, and I think it's been contracting for decades. This is something a lot of people haven't really taken the time to understand, but I would say more or less since we came off the gold standard in the 1970s and the deindustrialization of the 1980s, the standard of living in the United States for the broad base of the population has fallen. Now, we appear to be entering a period of time in which that standard of living is not falling imperceptibly. In other words, sort of over time in ways that you don't really notice. Now, it's really starting to accelerate, and especially so for Gen Z and millennial men. At the same time, there's been some real social scarring that's been done to men in the socio-sexual marketplace. Part of what I've tried to do on my channel, is I think you understand, Kyle, and expressed on the backlash, is that you talk about politics. Politics is sort of a narrow sliver of life. That's just one facet. But then you have the sexual, what's called the sexual marketplace. Mm-hmm. Then you have sort of the spiritual component of life. Then you have the concept of identity, the identity of the individual and the community and the state. All of these things are not accounted for in polling data. They don't show up in election after election in any way, shape, or form, but they are powerful forces that move societies in ways that are almost completely unexpected and unpredictable, largely because they're hard to quantify. They're very ethereal kinds of things. What's basically happened in the last 50 years is that the white population in general, and white men in particular, have been completely alienated from the institutions of power and the society that they built and established. Mm-hmm. That has created a revolutionary character, a kind of radicalization that is going to change this country, I think, systemically, root and branch. But that's an exogenous movement. That's what nationalism, again, is all about. This is the problem that you often hear when people say, well, what else are we supposed to do? We only have Trump, or we only have the Republican Party. That's a bankrupt way of looking at it. That's true if you accept that politics is everything. It's this sort of self-contained bubble that moves societies forward. Actually speaking, politics often doesn't change anything. It sort of follows what happens outside of that political structure. And right now, what I see is that the Overton window, as we understand it, is being smashed on the one hand. But on the other hand, the social scarring that's been done, particularly to young white men, that's really beginning to build into a movement. And I see that movement manifest everywhere. I see it in the manosphere, which, again, it's not strictly speaking political, but it's a sort of red pill community in which people are extremely hostile to feminism. They see very serious problems to marriage as a paradigm. They are increasingly disinclined or disenchanted with the 9-to-5 a structure of life. Again, that's another world-shattering position to take. I see it in crypto, where you have people that are increasingly evangelizing new technologies like Bitcoin. Again, if you were to talk to lawmakers about Bitcoin today, they say, oh, well, it's basically a Ponzi scheme, or it's some kind of internet token. Who cares about it? Bitcoin is a disintermediated banking system. And again, the Gen Z and millennial men, the engineers that built it and advocate for it, they understand that. It's a revolutionary technology, okay? That, again, is another expression of this sort of radicalization. And then, of course, we see it in the alt-right. The alt-right, again, what is it? It's not right. It's nationalist. That's why people are calling it alt or alternative, because it's something different. It's third rail. And that is manifest in, you know, the Groyper movements, people that follow Andrew Tate, and I think people that follow our podcast, probably your content as well. These are exogenous forces that are just beginning to smash through that sort of mainstream consciousness. That's where the source of the change is going to come from. And it is a reaction to the real danger, the scarring, the economic breakdown that I think is there. It's just not properly understood. Now, one final point on this is that what's the trigger? What's the triggering mechanism? It's the financial system. And I say that because if you really look at the economy in the United States, and I think in Western Europe as well, what's really propping it up is the government and you might say a financial corporate structure that's completely hollowed out. It's basically a lot of offshore money that's come into the United States to make money in the stock market or keep their assets in U.S. banks. It's not in factories, machinery. It's not in tanks and cranks. No. It's not in any of that. It's just sort of floating in our financial system. We are experiencing financial crisis, and that's happening everywhere. It's happening in the housing market. It's happening in private equity. It's happening in commercial real estate. And guess what? Now it's happening in the governmental sector. That's the last layer of defense. And when that starts to go, then the economic rot underneath will be fully understood and exposed. And that's when you're going to get profound political revolutionary change. And Kyle, I think it's imminent. I think it's beginning to happen.
Right. You touched on a lot there, and particularly I wanted to start with kind of the three things you laid out there, the manosphere, crypto, and the alt-right, but perhaps we could start with the manosphere because I am partially kind of in that realm as well. You know, I host Rule Zero, Post Zero, and I'm friends with a bunch of people in that
realm. I didn't know you hosted Rule Zero. That's very cool, Kyle. I used to watch Rule Zero all the time. Mm-hmm. Big fan of it.
Yeah, thank you. Well, yeah, I hosted it for my first time about 2-3 weeks ago, and we mainly talked about working out. So, I find the manosphere to be very interesting and essential for a lot of guys because it really, for, you know, probably the first time in most guys' entire lives to actually think about themselves first rather than think about what do I need to do for society, for women, for this, for that. It's good for guys to finally think like, no, what is best for me in this moment? And then once I finally kind of suit myself away, then I can decide what I want to do and how I want to do it. So, and that's just not something that guys ever hear. You know, we go through our entire lives, especially white men in this country, told that you're awful for being a white guy and that you need to suck it up and suffer for everybody else. But, you know, like I said, it's good for guys to finally hear like, no, you should focus on yourself and then you can figure out what you want to do from there. And I think that's a message that's resonating with a lot of people. And like you said, it's starting to manifest in different ways. And I think before that financial collapse, I think the guys who finally take it upon themselves to make themselves the best guys they could possibly be, or to be kind of like the leaders of the next generation.
Listen, I have written extensively about the manosphere. I started following the manosphere, I want to say in 2015, maybe 14, a long time ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I recognized, I would say a couple years in, what was happening. And basically it was a remasculinization program for men. That's what the manosphere is. And it's stacked with people like Richard Cooper, for example, who has a big YouTube channel called Entrepreneurs in Cars, I think, who are digital dads. They are becoming the surrogate fathers that society once provided, whether that was the biological father or the mentor or the hero. And I've made videos about this as well. You have three fathers that are necessary to transform boys into men. Productive, heroic, dynamic, charismatic men. The first is the biological father. Well, the statistics on that are frightening, right? Households in the country are overwhelmingly either, I would say, structurally fragile, meaning the relationship between the man and the woman or the father and the wife is just not very good, or they are broken. The father and the mother have divorced. Or there is no father. Okay. So that first pillar is wobbly or it's broken. The second is mentorship. Men don't have any mentors anymore. There's no framework. There are no institutions. There's no manor buns that are catered specifically to men. This is why Fight Club was such a profound film that awakened an entire generation of men. And I think succeeding generations to the fact that men had no place in society. We had no cause. We had no mission. We weren't part of anything, okay? What were the institutions that used to serve that purpose? The Boy Scouts, Dartmouth University, you know, right? In academic institutions that were male only. Now today that's basically a taboo. It's looked at as politically and otherwise unacceptable. You also had the military, which was once a very masculine enterprise. Now we see even sports, which again was a sort of venue where men had mentors, whether that was the coach or that was, you know, co-stars on your football team, whatever. Even that is being emasculated. Even that is subject to change based on transgenderism or DEI, you know, things of that nature. And then finally, it's the hero. Well, what are our heroes in Western white countries? We don't have any anymore. And to the extent that we do, we sort of have these imaginary, completely false comic book heroes who in many cases are betatized as it is. So you have these guys like Henry Cavill and others that are sort of not very believable. They're not all that compelling. They don't capture the attentions, the imaginations of young men and say, hey, I want to be like that guy in the same manner that my parents' generation had John Wayne or Clint Eastwood. And those were fictional characters as well, but they still had more gusto. They had more effect. So the manosphere has become a refuge for men that have been abandoned, that have been forsaken. Now, to compound all of this, you have what is an explosive situation in the sexual marketplace. Now, you said you're married and you have a child on the way. You're in the minority, my friend. I would say a growing, festering body of men is not only not in the sexual marketplace, they are spurned by the opposite sex, who regard them as worthless, who regard them as basically something to be ignored and forgotten. I think the statistics on this are alarming. Something like a third of men that are 30 and under are virgins.
Right.
They've never had any sexual activity with females at all. And an even larger percentage of them haven't had functional relationships with the opposite sex. Well, right. as it's well known at this stage, a smaller and smaller, a shrinking pie of men are monopolizing control of all the women. And then what makes it even worse is that men are told that these men that have access to all the women, that they are the high value men that they should aspire to be. These are people like Andrew Tate, for example. And those alpha males themselves are poisonous. They represent a cancerous system that's teaching these men the wrong values as it is. So that entire ethos has collapsed. That being said, the manosphere is responding to this. And I think men are on the right path. They're figuring out what's wrong. Feminism, wokeism, globalism. You want to know what's going on in the world. I tell people this all the time. Ask a guy who's 25. Don't ask a guy who's 55. The guy who's 55 is clueless. The guy who's 25 is not. And that suggests that these young men are the vanguard of the change to come. And that's where the change is going to come from. It's going to come from the vanguard of a new counter elite, if you will, that's going to harness the frustration of the broader masses, not the other way around.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case as well. You had mentioned men not having mentors anymore, and I've shared the story on the podcast plenty of times, but I was going to be an automotive instructor. So like I said earlier, I've been fixing cars for going on 14 years at this point, and I was going to step out to become a instructor. I was going to be a high school instructor for kids to teach them how to fix cars. And I thought about it. I'm like, you know, this is really cool because I'm going to be about 10 years older than most of these kids. And a lot of them, as you said, you know, they may not have their fathers present. They may not have a masculine role model. So it's like, okay, well, I'm going to be a relatable face who, you know, at the time would have been about 28, 29. So like you said, if you want to know what's wrong, ask somebody who's 25, not 55, because the 55-year-old dude, he got to, you know, grow up with like a booming economy, quote unquote, where the bubble was getting inflated, his assets got inflated. So life is good for him. But somebody that was like my age or even younger, we kind of see this as like, holy shit, you have a long, you know, rope to tow to really make your life something worthwhile. And, you know, I'm very, very lucky to have my wife, my house and my family and my network of people. But like you said, I'm kind of in the minority, so I try not to use my antidote for that. But once again, you know, they found out my political views and they said, oh, no, we can't hire you because, you know, you're a white guy who's, you know, way too far right. So, you know, now all these kids, they're not going to have a role model like myself to kind of teach them, you know, the way to go. And, you know, to have, you know, a guy who's slightly older than them, but can understand their struggle. And like you said, a lot of these men that are 18, maybe even 15 years old to 25 years old, they're looking at this whole economy and, you know, the global sexual marketplace that women have access to, and they're getting radicalized because the women don't want them anymore because, you know, they can see Andrew Tate, they could see actors, and they feel like they have the perception that they can get those guys and they're going to fly them out on their yachts and stuff like that, but that's not realistic. And guys just keep seeing us, they get more and more radicalized. And like you said, kind of towards the end of your point there, is that, you know, this is going to be kind of the new counter elite, if you will, or at least kind of like the masses. They're like, no, we need change.
Yeah, that's right. And notice that everything you just said, Kyle, none of it is political. A lot of the men you're talking about, they probably don't care about politics at all. Right. But by virtue of that awakening, and again, what is neo-masculinity? It's awakening to this mess, this crisis that we're in, which is decades old at this stage. Secondly, it's about resurrection. It's remasculinization, right? It's resurrecting that masculine archetype. And thirdly, it's about revolt. These men are beginning to discover that the only way to deal with the mess that we're in is to revolt, is to rebel against it. That's step one. We're there. So the next step is the main focus of my material, which is how to organize and philosophically gel that energy, because it is rather dangerous, right? That energy can be self-destructive if it doesn't become reformist in nature. And I think inevitably we're going to see some of that. We're definitely due for some major erratic behavior, some social unrest, and a period of real chaos. You know, it's interesting. I just read a very compelling article. I'll send it to you. It's worth reading. But it describes media today in contrast to the legacy media, you know, the sort of mainstream. You go from Dan Rather and Ted Koppel to CNN and Fox News, and what you're left with today is chaos media. Now, we might call that alternative media, but it's really not. It's chaos media. Why? Because even though you have a cottage industry of new thinking, of new reporting, of people like yourselves, like ourselves, for example, we lack authority. There is no authority right now. People don't know what to believe. They know that the legacy institutions are lying to them, but we don't have that authority yet. So what's going to happen is that chaos media is going to consolidate into authority media. That's where we're headed. We're just not there yet, but it's going to require a reformist movement to get there. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish with these young men, is to build them into a broader mass that can actually affect change. One other thing to note on this is that part of the problem with Andrew Tate and his ilk, and I don't necessarily dislike Tate either. I think Tate's a necessary person in many ways. Mm-hmm. But he is advocating for a methodology that preserves the existing system. He says, hey, don't fight the system. Enrich yourself. Get to the top of that system. That's the wrong approach. This system is cancerous. It is self-destructive. It's got to end. We need a new system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. And one of my friends in the chat had said that like Tate's an overcorrection, but I don't necessarily think that. I think he's a response to the current system where people have felt, you know, so deracinated that they looked at that and said, okay, well, you know, for the longest time, like I said earlier, we've had all these retarded men shoved down our throats. And even I think about media a little bit, and I threw out this tweet a couple weeks ago where like Reacher and Tracker are two shows that my wife and I watch, and like Reacher was pretty refreshing. And you know, I know Alan Richardson is a shit lib, he's, you know, out to lunch when it comes to politics, but like the overall meta of that show I think is very, very good, because it's a dude who looks fantastic. I mean, he's 6'3", jacked as hell, and then it doesn't have, like you said, an overt political agenda. It's just a guy who does what could be considered morally ambiguous acts, but it's also, you know, a man who's doing these things that isn't painted as some abuser or some evil guy or retard. He's painted as a competent, strong man. And I think hopefully we see more and more of that, because I think that kind of shows you that like the winds are starting to blow in a different way, rather than, you know, just constantly getting another Homer Simpson over and over again.
No, that's exactly right. Look, Tate, and I think Fuentes fits into this as well. Even Jordan Peterson and Donald Trump, to some degree, are transitional figures. Mm. And as such, if you think about it in terms of maturation, I would regard Tate and his sort of philosophy in this sense as adolescent, right? It's the teenage rebellion, and it's right. Needed, right? To your point, it's needed. It's basically telling these young men, look, this feminization, that's bullshit. Forget about it. You need to divest from that. And furthermore, you need to retrench around masculinity. He's right about that. But that's a sort of very adolescent way of thinking. I think Trump's rebelliousness matches that in a political sense. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would argue that Peterson is a little bit farther down the road in the sense that he's trying to intellectualize what's happening, but he is also a transitional figure because he's fallen short of addressing the seminal issue of our time, which is Zionism, which is dealing with the takeover of our society by a very narrow cadre of Zionist elites that are singularly responsible in many cases for a lot of the destructive ideas that we're contending with. And that's a bridge Peterson will not cross, which is why his star is falling. Okay. But we're on the path, on the right timeline. We're now getting closer to, I would say, that fully formed neo-masculine man who is set, as I said, to sort of reorganize, reform, and ultimately restore order to a bastardized Western world. Again, we're not finished as a society. This is not the end of Western civilization. We're just going into hard times that are going to necessitate nationalism. And guess what? That's arrived. Here we are.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad you finally touched on Zionism, because I know you guys talk about this quite a bit on the Backlash. But, you know, I do think that Donald Trump kind of represents like the last dying grips of Zionism, because I think the younger generations are starting to look at this and say, like, what the fuck are we doing sending all this money to another country? And I remember, I think it was on you guys' most recent episode where somebody said, like, oh, you guys should hate Muslims and, you know, some other race more than you hate Jews. But, you know, why is it that someone would say that? And why is it that we have a Muslim problem? Well, this comes back to certain interests that you and I think correctly believe have compromised our own president through, you know, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. And, you know, you see a lot of what is considered the right today saying, oh, we can't send this money to Ukraine, but they never, ever touch Israel. And who is the number one recipient of foreign aid? And who is the biggest donor to Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and Bob Menendez? It's AIPAC. It's Israel.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, this is another spin on what I said earlier. The system itself is broken. And Donald Trump felt, and he was probably right, that in order to become president, he had to capitulate on the Zionist question, that was the only way that he could affect the greatest political comeback of all time, as he puts it. He's probably right about that. And what is the result? The result is that it's destroying his presidency. And by extension, I think you're exactly right, Kyle. And I've said this before, what we just witnessed in 2024, in November, was the last election under the legacy constitutional Republican order. It's over. Mm-hmm. That's it. Because Trump was supposed to be the reformer that the normies who, as you correctly point out, who aren't privy necessarily to the rot and the cancerous developments that you and I are. They thought, hey, he's the plug and chug solution. And now that's self-evidently not the case. And I think it's going to destroy the Republican Party, but it's also going to destroy the Democratic Party as well. And that's exactly what we need to happen. We need these legacy institutions to be completely invalidated and delegitimized. And Trump is doing that, whether that's his intention or not. I have to say, I don't think Trump really understands a lot of this. I really don't. He's an old man. He's nearly an octogenarian. And throughout his life, there's been a constant. And that has been Zionist power in the United States, Zionist power in New York, Zionist power in real estate. And he's had to make amends for that power. Well, we're now at the end of this cycle in which we're going to have to deal with that if we're going to reform and save the United States. And that is a bridge too far for him. And that's why he's going to sink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of this is emblazoned by some of the executive orders and some of the other stuff that's been done strictly on the name of Israel. And, you know, I'm sympathetic to the argument that we need to deport people as fast as possible and as many as possible through whatever means necessary. But when I saw the Mahmoud Khalil case, and I can't remember the other lady's name, who just wrote an op-ed about calling for divestment from Israel, I was taken back, because I'm like, I don't think we should set the precedent that you can punish people on the basis of their speech against a foreign country. And I make this point all the time that if it was Joe Biden making executive orders and sending task forces to cities to punish people on the basis of anti-transgender bigotry, people would rightfully lose their mind. But we're doing it on behalf of one small group of people that everybody says, oh, well, if you hate them, then you hate America, because that's what you always hear. When you hear people talking about all of these Palestine protests or the protests of Israel, people are always saying, oh, well, they're saying death to America too. No, I don't think that's happening. I think that's being thrown in there on purpose because they want you to take your eyes off the ball and they don't want you to ask the questions that we're asking.
Yeah, I mean, look, the subversive impact of the Zionist influence is laid bare everywhere. And this example that you give is a perfect example, I think, of how these folks are sort of destroying themselves. people in our circles, as I'm sure you're well versed in, Kyle, believe that this problem is unassailable, that these people have all the capital in the world, that they're very high IQ, that they're entrenched in all the institutions of power. And on that basis, we're hopeless. There's nothing we can do about it. And this is sort of the right, the mainstream right-wing argument, right? This is the Charlie Kirk argument, is that, well, there's nothing we can do about it, so let's just try and evade that issue and work around it. Well, we're seeing Donald Trump's administration collapse under the weight of that lie on the one hand. But on the other hand, what you're beginning to see is that the mass immigration that the Zionists brought into the United States, and it wasn't exclusively them, but it was largely their influence, to be sure, is now boomeranging. It's now short-circuiting their own initiative to protect Israel. And this is happening in the United States. It's happening across Western Europe. And there are other problems with the initiative to diversify and pluralize the country as well. You know, resentment, resistance, if you will, to Zionism has always been stronger on the left than it has been on the right. And a lot of that comes from the very communities that they fetishize, whether they're Black Americans. You know, Louis Farrakhan has always been famously critical of the Zionist element in the United States and its control of the U.S. government or its influence on democratic politics. Okay, I mean the left wing of the United States. You're seeing similar criticism, I think, coming from the Justice Democrats and others that have had enough of this. So it's fracturing the very leftist movement that they set in motion to sort of destroy the United States. So I don't see this as the fait accompli destruction of America and their triumph. I actually see a lot of their influence beginning to undermine their own initiatives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And you mentioned Nick Fuentes earlier. He has a lot of good points, but sometimes I'm kind of about him. But I think he represents something that we've kind of been talking about throughout the show. And it's that the right is starting to ask these questions where, you know, the Charlie Kirks, the Ben Shapiros, all like the big, as I call them, like the NPC Trump influencers are kind of all in on Israel. But there's a growing faction, and as much as it kind of surprised me, I always found it weird, but like the Black parts that supported Trump, like the Black groups, so, you know, your Hodge twins, your Candace Owens, where they're still a little dumb on some issues, but they get this Israel issue right. And notice that like that never really gets noticed. But, you know, we're starting to see some new factions of the right turn on the Zionist project as well, which I think is honestly an optimistic note.
Yes. As I said, this is a process. It's an awakening. The manosphere, an awakening to the dangers of feminism. And of course, feminism is one or two steps removed from an awareness of globalism. Well, what's globalism, right? It all gets you back to the same thing. It is an awareness that the sort of legacy values that once held marriage and you might say fatherhood and masculinity together, that's withered on the vine. Then you have, as I pointed out earlier, crypto. Well, what's crypto an awareness of? That you have a bunch of bankers who have financialized the Western world, destroyed its economy, and are harvesting it for parts. Well, again, that's a few steps removed from the same issue that we're talking about in another regard. Look, I think Fuentes is sort of the death knell of the mainstream Con Inc. Republican Party. And he deserves a lot of credit for that. You know, certainly we can take issues with certain things that he says or maybe his behavior. I think like Tate, he is a transitional figure, but he's sort of a shaman that's whispering the animal spirits and facilitating this awakening. That is what he's doing. That is what needs to happen at the moment. Down the road, I think once awareness has hit a certain threshold, that's when we're going to start to stitch together these movements into real transformative political machines. We're just not there yet, but it's going to happen. So again, we're in a period of transition and awakening. That doesn't happen overnight. And it produces a lot of, I would say, extreme characters that through weight of propaganda, through weight of acrimony, shake up the status quo. That's what Tate is. That's what Fuentes is. To a lesser extent, some of these other folks, that's what Trump is. But they're not the reformers who are poised, I think, to come in and stitch back the mess together. That's where we come in.
Yeah, I agree. And I like I said, I think it's an optimistic note as well. One thing you've covered in your videos as well, which is something that I focus on quite a bit as well, is China. And China is a very, very interesting topic. And I think a lot of right wingers get this issue wrong. You know, I don't necessarily see them as hostile to the United States. I more so see them as like, they've kind of figured it out. Like we, you know, at one point in the United States kind of figured it out. I always say now that like China is becoming what the US used to be and the US is becoming what China used to be. So like we're kind of trading places where like China has all the manufacturing superpower. They're starting to raise their average citizens, you know, quality of life drastically, where now in the West, we're seeing that decline. And of course, you know, the State Department's goal through, you know, every single time they publish a national defense strategy, and you even seen Pete Hegseth talking about this last, I think it was last week, where they're saying, oh, no, no, we still got to ship more weapons and stuff and focus on kind of like Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific, as they call it. That's because once again, China has figured out that, oh, no, no, we could be a superpower too. But, you know, the one thing that China has that we don't, homogeneity. And they also don't have a Zionist problem over in China. So they got manufacturing super, you know, they're a manufacturing superpower, and they're not dragged down by wars. They have some hostile neighbors, sure, and they still have demographic issues, but they're starting to figure all this stuff out, where we're starting to inherit all those problems they used to have. So where do you see China and the relation to the US going in like the next decade?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I'm fortunate. I used to live in Hong Kong, and I spent time in Asia. I've been to Japan, I've been to Singapore, I've been across South Asia. I've also been to South America, the Middle East, and Europe. And I say that because when you travel these places and you really have some context for what you're talking about, whether it's geopolitically, economically, or otherwise, it really helps shape your worldview for the better. There are just too many people in D.C., New York City, I would include Brussels, maybe London, that have no idea what's going on in China. And frankly, they don't really understand what's happening in Asia in general. And that's true in Europe as well. I mean, the numbers of Americans I meet who sort of don't understand why the Europeans don't all just fall in line to the EU, and isn't the ECB just kind of like the Fed? I mean, you'll hear Americans say this stuff. And it's complete ignorance. It's not anchored to reality at all. Regarding China, China is ascendant, and as you point out, you're correct. They are following our playbook, the playbook that basically characterized the United States from 1870 to 1970. You know, I encourage people to read a book. It's called "The Rise and Fall of American Growth," written by Robert Gordon. It's one of the best books, maybe the best book ever written about the United States economy and our ascension as a great power. And what effectively did we do? Well, we spearheaded industry, right? We saw the flowering of the internal combustion engine, electrification, and there was a public-private partnership invested in building the infrastructure, the human capital, the capital relationships to make all of that possible. And of course, what animated it was the white population, specifically men. These are the men that worked at the Willow plant when 50,000 workers in 1944 could put out a bomber an hour, okay? This is the power of the United States. The Chinese looked very carefully at us and they said, we don't like your political system. We think it's broken, and we think it's basically degenerated into a plutocracy. But we understand how you became a great power. Industry, manufacturing, petrochemicals, and that is basically what they have tried to duplicate, and it's taken them a long time to do. This is what people don't understand. They think China has sort of risen in the last 10 or 20 years. That is not the case. This is a process that started in the 1980s when Deng Xiaoping became the leader of China, and it wasn't led from the top down. It was led at the provincial level, largely by partnerships between provincial governments and local businesses. That's what spearheaded China's ascension to power. And now, as you point out, they've got the supply chains, they've got the human capital, they've got the trade schools, they've got the engineering institutes, and slapping them with tariffs is not going to change that equation. In fact, tariffs, which can be effective, by the way, people that say tariffs don't accomplish anything, they're wrong. But they're designed, or at least historically, they were designed to protect nascent industry, to protect infantile, inchoate textile factories or engineering companies from predatory overseas competition. That's what they were designed for, not to reshore root and branch, whole supply chains, whole industries from scratch. The issue that Trump has, just as an aside, is that we have to definancialize first, then we can reindustrialize, okay? The Chinese are sort of the opposite, as you point out. They're what we used to be. They are industry first, finance second. And they don't want to be the world reserve currency. As far as the destiny of China relative to the United States, well, I think that depends on us. If we get our act together and we prioritize our hemispheric interests and realize that China doesn't pose any threat to us, then our relationship with China will be very good. The Chinese admire the United States. They, as I said, they're modeling a lot of what they're doing on us. They don't want to be the world reserve currency. Just as a funny fact, I looked up the number of military bases the Chinese have outside of China. It's like one or two officially in the world. We have, what, 700, 800 in 100 countries around the world? Who are we kidding? And the biggest threat that the Chinese worry about all day long is that they've got 500, 600, 700 million Chinese that are still living in the 19th century. That is the hurdle that they have to overcome. It's going to take them another 50 years to deal with that. And that's assuming their society survives, that their state survives. Okay. One other thing that, that's very important to note on this is that you hear a lot of buffoons like Peter Zeihan say that China's going to collapse because they have a demographic problem, because they're not producing enough children. That is absurd. China has too many people. They've had too many people for 100 years, hundreds of years. It is not about the volume of people in your society or how many people are reproducing, okay, relative to who's dying. It is about how productive your population is. They're homogenous, they're high IQ, and they're productive. We in the West, as you well know, have imported tens of millions of people that are non-white for the last 50 years, and we're sinking in debt. And we are not productive. Why? Because human capital is everything. But the institutions of power in China are aligned with the national identity of the population. Ours are not. That's the difference.
Yeah, tons and tons of good points there. And I completely agree, especially about the tariff argument. And that's something that I haven't heard a lot of people address, is that, you know, China has the manufacturing talent as well. Where I believe in the American people, I do believe that we can regain that talent, but it's a muscle that we haven't flexed in a very, very long time. So there's going to be some growing pains. But if just slapping tariffs and making everything more expensive for Americans to consume, you don't have the factories here. Like, you know, I'm a General Motors technician and I love General Motors vehicles, but, you know, they're like, you know, anywhere from about 60 to like 80% produced here, just because we don't have those manufacturing factories anymore. In my mind, if Trump was smart, and let's face it, he's not, you would incentivize these factories to come back here. You would, you know, hell, even instead of sending money over to Israel or Ukraine or Taiwan, you would just say, hey, we're going to give you government grants and we don't care what you do. We're going to have these factories back here in America. We'll pay you to do it. And then let's, you know, bring this manufacturing back. We'll even pay people to go to school so they can learn, you know, how to build, you know, whatever vehicles here, rather than us having to pay China to produce them and then bring them over here. That would make sense to have tariffs in that situation. But right now we don't have that. Like you said, you can't use them as a tool to reshore.
Yeah, look, people just don't understand that the Chinese are leading in electric vehicles. They're leading in lithium battery tech. They are leading in industrial robots. They're competitive in AI. They're leading in pharmaceuticals, in nuclear plants. Why is this? Because they've onshored the industry, because they have access to the lithium deposits that they need in Kazakhstan, okay? Because they just built a $3.5 billion port in Peru so that they can bypass California and ship huge amounts of goods in between South America and Asia. Okay. It's like opening a whole new trade relationship that's going to revolutionize the economy in South America. This has been their focus for the last 20 years. By contrast, what are we doing? We're bombing the Houthis. We're threatening war with Iran. We're sanctioning the Russians. We're talking about a pivot to Asia so that we can fight the Chinese. We're spending all of our money on defense and welfare. This is the issue: to internally reform first. Then we can structurally change our relationships with China and other countries. Trump has got it backwards. But remember, he is a conservative. He's trying to conserve the status quo. That status quo is broken. It needs to be overhauled. Yeah, just real quick, Kyle, I need to plug my computer in. So let me do that real quick and I'll be right back on. Okay.
Yeah, no problem.
Running a business can be exhausting. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI. From site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want the way you want. And manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
Open the door to savings with beautiful Mastercraft doors at Menards. Mastercraft steel entry doors add security and improve the appearance of your home. Choose from our huge in-stock selection or design your door your way with our free step-by-step design program. Online or in-store, save big on Mastercraft doors at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
While he is doing that, I'll remove him from the screen for a minute while he's getting all that plugged in. Yeah, I think some of like the power, Jacob said, I also don't think they have the ability like they're pretending they do, a paper dragon, so to speak. Yeah, I largely agree. I don't think they have all this military might that people kind of believe they have. And I think that's honestly for the best. I think that China is focused on China. Xi Jinping is focused on China, right? Like Cameron was saying, they're focused on their national identity and their sovereignty and their prosperity. The U.S. isn't doing that right now. I think Trump, I think his heart's in the right place in this respect, as in like he would like to see a little bit more nationalism, but I just don't think he has the smarts, the capability, or the people around him to really implement an agenda like that. Russia versus vis-a-vis China. Why bark yourself when you have a dog? A little crass, but you get the idea. I'm not sure I follow you entirely, but like same deal with Russia. I think Russia is trying to make themselves great again also, and kind of focus on their national identity as well. Let me see some of these other comments here. Sun Tzu, The Art of Fighting. Yeah, I saw something earlier today. Not sure if it's true, but it said that China doesn't drop any bombs, whereas the United States drops an average of 46 bombs a day. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the amount of drone strikes and civilian casualties and all that stuff from the first Trump presidency and then obviously Obama's presidency over his 8 years, I could believe that completely. And you have to imagine they're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on some of these military adventures, and it's not ending well. Yeah, it's just not good. Let me see what else here. Oh, now I'm having connectivity issues. Hopefully it's not too bad. Yeah, DC as a whole has their head up their asses. Yeah, completely agreed. As long as we're subservient to Israel, our leaders will never promote true nationalism. Okay, here we go. All right. So I entitled the show today, The Next American Revolution. I think we've kind of danced all around it today, but maybe we could kind of wrap on that because I know you're on a little bit of a time limit. So, what do you see as the next American Revolution? I know you kind of said a financial kind of collapse or something akin to that. What and when do you see this taking place, if you have any kind of idea as far as that's concerned?
I think it's happening, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think it is a process that probably started a decade ago. Let me give you some historical context. In the latest video that I made, I think you alluded to it earlier, I talked about succession versus secession. I talked about the American Revolution, which really wasn't a revolution. It was sort of a war of separation from England, in which we were a self-contained, fully functioning society. And we just said, look, we don't want to pay the taxes that that you're imposing upon us. But more importantly, we want to govern ourselves. We have the capacity to determine our own national destiny. In the lead up to that war, however, you had something called the Great Awakening. And the Great Awakening was a religious movement among Protestant communities across the United States. It really was the beginning of America's national identity. And one of the cornerstones of that was that we don't want an established church from England or practically from anywhere, in this case, Anglicanism, because Protestant religions were flowering across the United States. So in implicit in a new society was a separation of church and state to permit those Protestant religions from fully flowering wherever they may go. That was a pre-revolutionary kind of movement. And that's, as often happens, revolutions are sort of the culmination point. So are wars, by the way. They tend to reflect changes that have already happened. And then when the war occurs, the dust clears and everybody says, okay, now what we thought was coming, it's arrived. Okay. De-dollarization is an example of this, right? Is that you sort of see the seeds of de-dollarization everywhere. You get something like BRICS or you have crypto, but nobody buys it until you get that event that sort of breaks the back of the dollar. But actually, when you look back, you say, well, this process started a long time ago. BRICS has been around since, I think, 2000, 2007, 2008, something like that. It formalized, I think, in 2011 when South Africa joined it. That's a long time ago, okay? The Great Awakening preceded the American Revolution in a similar way. Today, as we said earlier, you've got this sort of renaissance happening in masculinity. Some of that's happening in the ministry. You've got a technological revolution happening with Bitcoin and potentially other cryptocurrencies that are disintermediating the banking system. Now, they don't have mass adoption yet, but they're on the path, okay? At the same time, you've got, I think, a growing awareness in not just the alternative right, but I think in the white population in the United States, the founding population, if you will, that the immigration into the country, that the subversion of the government by foreign entities like the Zionists, as an example, are an existential threat to the United States. Now, that awareness hasn't mainstreamed, per se, hasn't produced, other than Donald Trump and MAGA, and I suppose you could say the Tea Party, which was an effort by the boomers to just sort of put a brake on the fiscal spending of the country that they had gotten completely out of control. But even under those movements, you've seen sort of incremental steps in the direction of this nationalism that I'm talking about. We're in the final stage of that. What's going to trigger it is, I think, a financial meltdown, because the financial meltdown is going to fully invalidate the institutions of power. It will break the social contract completely. People already have lost trust. That is an unassailable point. All the poll numbers show that. People don't trust Congress. They don't trust the banks. They don't trust the media. They don't trust the president. Trust is broken, okay? The next step is for the social contract to basically be completely invalidated. And what does that mean? It means people say, look, I'm not going to send my taxes. I'm not going to pay for taxes anymore. Or they say, I'm not going to follow these laws anymore. Or I'm not going to put people in prison for saying certain things about Zionism, okay? We're not there yet, but we're very close to that. I think the trigger is going to be financial. However, there is also a very real possibility that all of this is induced by a war with Iran. Now, we haven't talked about that yet on your program, but this war with Iran could be the catalyst for a global war. Very definitely could. It's not just that the Russians back Iran. It's also that the entire Middle East is turning against us. It's turning against the United States. It's turning against the Western world. We have tens of thousands of troops that are scattered across that region that are extremely vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Our naval forces are old, decrepit, poorly trained, poorly staffed. They're vulnerable. And so what you could see happen is we could end up in a war with Iran, and they have the missile tech to do real damage to our forces. We could lose capital ships. We could lose people and bases like Bahrain by the thousands. And what would that do psychologically to the credibility of the Trump administration or the credibility of Congress? I think it would break it. I think it would break it full stop if something like that were to happen. Can something like that happen in the short term? Yeah, I think so. I think so. And remember that in the shadows, there is also the possibility of a nuclear exchange with Iran. And there's open discussion that we may potentially allow the Israelis, or rather we may use limited nuclear strikes to take out their nuclear facilities, which would be a disaster for the world, not just the United States. What I'm saying here is that there are vulnerabilities everywhere. The system is sort of fragile like glass, and there are cracks that are already there. It's not going to take much more for that facade of American invulnerability to smash. And I think when it smashes and the social contract breaks, that's the revolutionary moment. That's the tennis court moment, if you will, referencing the French Revolution. That is sort of the 1776 Declaration of Independence, or the Harper's Ferry moment before the Civil War. We're there. We're knocking on the door. It could also be some kind of a war with Mexico that triggers this as well, because you have serious racial nationalist conflict between the Mexicans that live not just in California, but across the country, and white Americans. Okay. And Mexicans in general tend to be very nationalistic. They tend to be very prideful of Mexico. And that's a problem. This is something Huntington wrote about again, 20 years ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there are fault lines everywhere. And the radicalization that we've spoken about in this program is already there. So I guess what I'm saying is you got the compressed air. You sort of have the combustion chamber. Now we just need that atomized fuel. What's that atomized fuel going to be? Could be a war with Iran. Could be a war with Mexico. Could be a financial meltdown. Could be all of the above. We'll see. Could be something else. But we're almost there. We're almost there.
Well, I think kind of like you said on, throughout our talk today, is that I think hopefully people like us will kind of be here to help guide people in the right direction. Now, I don't consider myself a great man. I aspire to be, you know, a great father and a great person in my community. I look at my father and my grandfather as great men, but I think that's the way we all view our own fathers. But, I guess we'll kind of have to see how this stuff goes. But I do have faith in the American people, and I think that's kind of the optimistic note. I think there's people like you and I and your co-hosts on The Backlash that, can hopefully steer the ship in the right direction, and I'm sure playing mutual friends of ours. So I guess we should wrap on what kind of gives you hope for the future.
The ability to scale movements today is greater than it's ever been. Again, I go back to Bitcoin, right? There are Bitcoin communities, there are Bitcoin Twitter spaces and political movements all over the world, in China, in the United States, in Europe. And again, the ability to build that network or proliferate that network is greater today than it's ever been. That's just a technological example. Think of like the printing press during the Protestant Reformation, okay? I made a video, I want to say 6 months ago, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, about what I call network men and what alternative media really is. Again, people, I just think in our day and age, they're just not thinking in these terms, which is why I try to use the reframing that I do. Neo-masculinity, masco-nationalism, neo-leviathan, things of that nature. But the French Revolution began in the coffee houses of Paris. That's where they started. What are the modern day equivalents of those coffee houses? It's this platform. It's this discussion we're having right here. Mm-hmm. It's Twitter. It is all of these alternative media platforms, podcasts, et cetera, where these kind of discussions are being hosted and new figures, a new cadre, if you will, a new vanguard is being built. So again, the infrastructure that's going to scaffold this movement It's already there, Kyle. It is not hopeless. But you have to think about it. You got to reframe it in these terms to understand historically how these things happen. Because, again, people look back and they say, oh, but you had this leader and you had this movement. Nah, not really. Not really. The Jacobins were a cafe society. That's it. They were nothing. And then all of a sudden the revolution happened and boom, everything changed because they became a scaffolding to reorganize a movement. That is exactly what alternative media represents today. It's what Bitcoin, the Bitcoin community represents. It's what the Manosphere is. This is spontaneous reorganization into a broader political movement. And I think that all of these things are going to consolidate together. That is the vision that I have. They will consolidate when the emergency, when that sort of state of exception arises. And as I said, I think we're almost there.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny that you mentioned crypto and the Manosphere because I am seeing a lot of overlap between those two. So I think you're absolutely right. Cameron, you know, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. We'll definitely have to do another one sometime. That thoroughly enjoyed it. One of the best podcasts I think I've done in a very, very long time. Let everybody know where they could find you, your work, and all that good stuff, and we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I promise to be in a studio next time so I don't disrupt your programming. So anybody that was listening, that was exclusively my fault and not Kyle's. Anyway, yes, people can find me. I'm a co-host of The Backlash, as Kyle mentioned earlier. I'm glad people like that show. We're growing. And again, our mission on that podcast is not simply to have a good podcast. We want to platform other people. We want to be a facilitator, if you will, of a right-wing media. Reorganize all of these folks and bring them together under some kind of umbrella. So you can follow me at the Backlash. Second, I have my own YouTube channel, Neo-Masculinity, or you can just type in Cameron McGregor, Men in the City. And then finally, you can follow me on Substack, where I write generally one essay a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, but I write about everything, dating, politics, travel, all kinds of stuff. That's called Men in the City. So follow me on Substack as well. It's been a real pleasure, Kyle. Thank you for the work that you do. Just by virtue of getting your voice out there and platforming people like myself, you are part of the solution. And that deserves praise. So thank you for what you do. And I enjoyed the conversation.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Feeling is absolutely mutual. And everybody, thank you so much for the active chat today. And then until next time, everybody, make sure you take care and rock and roll.